And we're going to bring on our second guest right now. We're going to talk about survival tips. We're going to talk about some bug-out bags and whatever else this fine gentleman wants to talk about. Wolfman is in the house. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hello, and thanks for having me on the show.
All right. Welcome in. And so I saw your website, the Wolfman website here, and let me grab that back up. I should still have it.
Sure, and that's Wolfman. There's two A's on that.
Right. Thanks for helping us. We do have listeners that take in the rebroadcast, so they might want to check that out. All right, let me just pull up Wolfman again here. There he is. Adventurer, travel writer, and outdoor educator.
That's correct.
All right, let me go ahead and throw the link in the freedomizer.com website here. And Felicia's here as well.
Hello.
Hi there, how are you?
Not too bad.
We're talking to Canada right now.
Good to meet you.
Thanks, thank you.
What part of Canada are you from?
Right now I am in southern Ontario, so it's we call it the Niagara region. It has a bunch of cities, St. Catharines, Niagara Falls, Niagara-on-the-Lake, and a few other little ones in there.
Excellent. I just happened to click on here. I listen to 80s music. I'm 40 years old, so obviously that's the generation of music I grew up with. And I just heard a song today called Doctor and the Tardies, and it's a throwback to Doctor Who. And I see on here Wolfman discovers the Tardies.
Absolutely. I'm a bit of a Whovian. And I was working at an outdoor education facility in St. Catharines a couple of years ago. And I saw that, and we had discussed the idea with a few of the guys who I do filming with, and thought it would be kind of a fun and silly fan film to make.
All right. So I'm guessing you could probably teach people a thing or two in here, because that's kind of what we do. You have a bunch of how-to videos.
Absolutely. I started out actually doing travel videos. Back in 2009, I was the first person to hike the entire Bruce Trail end-to-end. I was the first person to hike it barefoot, which was kind of an interesting thing. It sort of helped my career in travel writing and outdoor education. So I had to learn a whole bunch of different things, in survival and making sure that along the 800, but still something like 600 miles, that I was going to be okay, right? Because I wasn't always in the cities. I wasn't always in contact with other people, so I was always learning and growing. Growing up on a farm, you learn a lot of different stuff, and just sort of honed it. From there, I ended up having two different schooling, one through recreation and leisure, and the other was through wildlife forestry conservation. So I just sort of kept building on that until I got to the point where I was ready to teach some classes.
All right. So anything, Felicia, you want to know about in regards to survival skills or bug-out bags or anything like that?
You know, one of the things that I'm always most interested in is I know a lot of people stock food and they keep lots of canned goods and things like this on hand, and they're able to find ways to cook and prepare food. But one of the things that I'm always concerned with is if there was a serious catastrophe, it seems to me that most people don't have a plan for sanitation and water, because you can't cook, you can't survive without clean water. And that's one of the things I'm always interested in, and I was wondering, how you can help people prepare for that.
Sure, absolutely. Usually most people who create a plan, a disaster relief plan, and for people who are, believe that the government is against you for all of these things, there's a large campaign out right now. I travel a lot, and I was in Chicago recently. They have billboards up that are actually saying, you should be doing this now. So it's very, very important to do it. There's two different plans that you can make. The first one is a stay-in or stay-at-home plan. These ones are usually the most accommodating. So you would say, okay, power goes out, bad storm, depending on where you live. I have to stay in my home for so many days. These are easy to plan for because you can get, large drums, like the 50-gallon drums of water. Like you can buy a 50-gallon drum, fill it with water, and just change it out every 3 to 6 months so it stays fresh for you. You always have, and then you can think of, you know, things in your house, like, do I have pets I have to care for, young children, elderly, anything that you need that you're saying, okay, if I'm without power or water, what do I need every single day to survive? So you start your planning. Well, I need to brush my teeth. You may need to shave. You may need this. You may need that. You're going to need food. You're going to need water. So you start to sort of build up from day to day, what do I need to have to make sure that over a period of 3 to 5 days, I have everything. And again,
right,
in a house, this is really easy. Like you were saying, stockpiling canned goods. What I recommend my students to do is every time you go grocery shopping, when you see stuff on sale, buy one or two extra cans. That costs you less than $5 on your grocery bill, but over a period of 6 months, you're going to have a sizable food supply that basically you didn't notice that it cost you. Right?
Right,
so I
right.
go and I buy, you know, 4 tins of tuna. Well, I'm going to buy 5. I bring it home. I write the date on it, throw it in a cupboard. I go out and I see, oh, ramen noodles are on sale. Go buy a case of those things. They're usually super cheap. You know, just write the date on them, throw them in your cupboard. And over time, you have enough that you're like, oh, now I can survive for a month or whatever. And it didn't be like, oh, there's something happening in 2 weeks. Now I don't have the, I don't know, $500 for food or whatever.
Right, right, right. The other thing I'm always curious about is extremely perishable items. Like when you're in a crisis or an emergency, is that a point where really you're only going to be able to eat from a can for a while, or is there a way that you can preserve things like flours and salts and things so that you can still be making fresh foods for your family, do you know what I mean, in case this is a long-term prolonged process, and how would you keep things like that fresh?
Sure, absolutely. That's a great question. And as part of your, you know, like I was saying, plan A of your bug out is to stay put. And that's usually the safest thing to do if your situation will allow. We have to look back in history and think of how long we actually had refrigeration, which is only,
mm-hmm.
you know, electricity, a little over 100 years, something in and around that time. Humans have been around the planet for a significantly longer time than that. So there's always different ways that you can keep food, you know, fresh and prepared and ready for eventualities like this. Depending on the time of year, if you're in an environment that you get cold weather, that you get like winter, you can actually, depending on the situation, you can store some of your food either in an area of your house that's not heated, like an attic or something like that, if you can access it, or even outside.
Right.
Of course, there's always a possibility of looting if that happens, but let's say it's something like a power outage where there's, you know, everything is civil and safe. It's just inconvenient for a couple of days. In that case, you can move all your stuff outside. There was a big power outage, I'm trying to think of the year. It was some time ago where we had half of the Eastern Seaboard went out for a couple of days. I'm sorry, I don't remember the exact date. And we had that.
Oh,
it was
okay.
in the wintertime, and people were just storing their food in Rubbermaids outside. There's a lot of advice on the internet that you can find and how to keep and prepare things, like you said, like flour, how to learn how to salt meats, how to create beef jerky, things that I could spend lots and lots of time talking about. But it's just as easy to learn some of that stuff off the internet, you know, if you don't have a lot of time. Or, of course, go in and take an instruction course. I'm a professional instructor, and I offer weekend courses, and there's tons and tons of really fantastic schools all around North America and the world that will show you how to look for food, how to go out into your garden and say, okay, what can I eat, what can't I eat, how to go out into a city park and say, oh, I recognize what this plant is, I recognize what that plant is, I can eat this. You'd be surprised where you can find wild edibles in, like when it's in growing season in summertime and in early fall.
Right, right. I think they probably have the shortest growing season.
So you have here with cattails. What can you tell us about cattails?
Oh, cattails are one of those amazing plants that you can use them throughout the year, and I believe you were looking at the one video that I made. Actually, it's a series of 3 videos. You can do a lot with a cattail. You can do everything from making insulation for your bed or for a jacket. You can make mattresses with it. You can make arrows out of it for hunting with. You can even eat parts of the bottom. You can use it for even like making different projects. I don't know if you would need those in like a stay-home survival situation, but they're always readily available. Most of North America, places, parts of Russia, have like cattails. They're also known as bulrushes in some parts. They're abundant. There's different parts that you can take the roots out and soak them in water and mash them up and make flour from the stuff that comes out of the starch. There's lots and lots of different things you can do with those.
What do you find is the first thing that most unprepared families do in a crisis situation that they shouldn't be doing? Where are we the least prepared?
Normally it's in lack of preparedness when everything is going well. So we say, okay, everything is going well, bam, a crisis hits. And we had that with the different hurricanes that hit the eastern seaboard. Fortunately, people who live in places like Florida and Louisiana, they always have that on their mind because they're hit more often with severe weather. But like the Northeast, when it got hit, they weren't quite as well prepared. Is that everybody doesn't think about their preparedness plan until it's too late. And it's very simple and can be, again, like I was saying with the groceries, can be fairly inexpensive to do if you time it properly. A lot of times what people will do is when a crisis hits, I've got to go, and they look at two things. They want to get fuel for their car and they want to get groceries. So they're going to go to those two places, fuel stops and grocery stores, and that is where trouble starts. There's rioting sometimes. They always say that in less than 12 hours, a grocery store, a large-size grocery store, will be sold out of product. So it's always important to remember that you probably won't have that product. If you leave this to the last minute, and then all of a sudden you have a situation on your hands, and you drive to your grocery store, it could be half a mile wait to get there. By the time you get there, it could be empty, or worse, you could be putting yourself in danger trying to get there. And during a crisis, as much as we like to think that, you know, police, military, National Guard will be available, they might be dealing with more severe problems than a ride at a grocery store.
Right. Right, absolutely. How would you go about properly housing gasoline on your property for a crisis or emergency?
Well, a common thing that people do is they stockpile fuel either in a vehicle or in tanks. But the problem with that is over time, it will actually degrade and go into what we call a varnish state, which is just unusable fuel. There's different products available. You can look them up on the internet and you can get them that are additives to the fuel that will make it last a lot longer. So you could keep it in jerry cans in your garage. Obviously, you want to keep it in a space that you're not going to be regularly breathing the air. For example, don't keep it in your living room or you have a wood stove. Something like that. But you can definitely stockpile fuels for a certain amount of time as long as it's rotated and as long as you add some of these chemical treatments to help it last longer. Some of the things other people do will get a lower grade engine. So, like our modern day vehicles, they're very specific in the kinds of fuel that they run. It has to be fresh and it has to be a certain quality. Whereas older vehicles, like if you have an antique army jeep, will run on pretty much anything. Even old stale fuel, you can sometimes get them to run. So people will think about, if I have an antique jeep or something, or even some of the older ATVs, the all-terrain vehicles, will run on a lower quality fuel.
Interesting. Is that something we need to worry about? Like I live in Nevada, and during the summertime, it's hotter than heck out here. Would I need to worry about keeping that outside in the garage during that severe heat weather?
As long as it's vented, it won't be too much of a problem. Where the problem is with a lot of fuels, our fuel expands and contracts at a greater rate than something like water would. So you would have to be concerned with, if the fuel expands to a point where it's pushing out on the container, if it's not properly vented, it can pop. And then, if you have 20 liters or that would be about 5 gallons of gasoline spread all over your floor, that's a huge problem to contain.
Right.
Hey, I like your Thunderbox here on the website.
Oh, yes. That was built from 100% recycled materials. I got involved in buying some land with a few people to run some courses on, and this one gentleman managed to get a whole bunch of skids, like pallets, shipping crate pallets, and we pulled them all apart and made a really, really great box for pooping in.
Hey, you can never turn down a good commode, that's for sure.
Well, I spend a lot of time in the wilderness, and a lot of the time is in backcountry and remote areas, And there is nothing better than a proper sit-down to do your business. It's, you know, doing it against a tree or all the other different methods that are out there. There's nothing as good as actually sitting down. So when I run courses, I try to make my students very comfortable by doing just that, providing them with different boxes and stuff like that, so that's a little easier to do.
Hey, I do see here about archery, and that's something I really want to get into this year.
Oh, absolutely. Archery is very, very ancient. It's been around for, you know, thousands of years. As far as you can make your own arrows, you can make your own bows. There's a really great organization up here in Canada called Sticks and Stones Wilderness School, and they have a bow-making workshop. So you go and you take like a piece of a tree. They tell you what kind of tree to harvest, and you take your knife and you carve it away, and you actually make a bow out of this. And then they show you how to make the arrows. They always say when you look at it from a survival perspective, anything past 6 weeks, your technical survival skills, like the equipment that you have, is going to start running out or breaking down. So the second part of your average bug-out plan is a leave-home plan, right? Your primary and most ideal situation is to stay with your home. That's where you have all your stuff, your valuables, your trinkets you've collected, family heirlooms. But you may be in a situation where you have to leave. So planning on being able to carry everything that you need to survive on your back is very good. Just earlier, you were talking about firearms. You're not going to carry 10 handguns and 5 rifles and 1,000 rounds of ammunition on your back with your food and your family and everything else. Any of you who are in the military, your listeners will know ammunition is super heavy, right? They're lead. Not fun to carry. Not something that, unless you're in tip-top physical shape, that you're going to be able to hoof everything you need around for a while and potentially run away from any form of predator that you come, human or otherwise.
Hey, let me mention, too, that a lot of people talk with prepping. A lot of the first conversations happen to be the food, the water, and ammunition. But no one takes into effect or account the sanitations, the bandages if you need them. I know Felicia is pretty heavy into oils that are fairly lightweight that can help you in the event of emergencies as well, or general cleanliness. Do you partake in any of that?
Oh, absolutely. As a CPR instructor, like I was saying, after so many weeks, what's going to happen, you know, if you're in a really bad situation, you're going to need to be able to, you know, you're going to end up ditching your firearms, you know, because it's just dead weight, right? You're going to have to be able to use things like herbs. You're going to have to know your wild edibles. You're going to have to be able to take cattails, make arrows, make bows if you're not setting out with one. But for sure, keeping clean is one of the most important and underrated parts of survival. Like we were saying earlier, stockpiling water, understanding how to boil water. It's very well noted in the Leave No Trace theory that there's no clean drinking water in North America. There's nothing safe. During the time of a catastrophe, you never know what has gotten into that water. During World War II, what they used to do is take like dead animal parts and then throw them into wells, so that if a soldier or somebody drank from that water, they would instantly get poisoned unless they took care of it. Even though, you know, in a deep well, you may not see stuff that's gotten thrown into the bottom. So keeping clean, keeping your water boiled, understanding having the fire skills, the technical skills to make fires using bow drills, hand drills, even things like the ferrosium rods. There's like this, like a little stick you can get at most camping and outdoor stores. You hit it with a hard stick that comes with it, like a piece of metal, and it will spark. So if you can understand how to get all that done, even in adverse conditions, then you can go ahead and say, okay, now I can boil water. Now I can look for my wild edibles. Now I can use, different things like plantain and all the other things that grow wild and will all continue to grow wild long after humans are gone in order to help cure disease. So it's very, very important to take a look at your wild edibles, understand what's in your area. A lot of times people will get the wild edible books and it'll be like, oh, I'm in southern Ontario and all these plants are in Arizona, or the other way around. So it's important to kind of have an idea of You know, I won't find very many wildcat guy. There are a few, but I won't find very many of them in Ontario. But, you know, you certainly would in Arizona.
Right, and I don't know if you recommend anything as far as water purification. Of course, one of my good friends is the Berkey guy. He sells Berkey's. Dr. Prepper, who's a show host with us on Saturdays, sells aqua pails and aqua bricks, where you could take some water that is not really fit for human consumption, run it through the filtration, and you'll at least have drinkable water.
Absolutely. And again, thinking that unless you collect the water yourself using a survival method, like you dig a hole in the ground, you put a tarp over the hole and you put some stones in it, in the middle, that makes like a funnel, clean water will collect on there. If you're collecting dew by wrapping rags around your feet and ankles and you walk through an area that has fresh dew on it, it'll collect and you can squeeze that out. Unless you're using those kind of methods, you're absolutely right. You should definitely have something in your pack to purify water with other than just fire. If you have the opportunity to get, there's all different things. You can buy filters, you can make filters. I've made filters using things like sand, charcoal embers, and stones, and you put them in like a milk bag. You know, like the, I'm not sure in the United States, but in Canada, they were called them a 2-liter milk bag. And we pack everything in, you cut a hole in the bottom, put your dirty water in at the top, and it comes out, filters it, comes out clean like a Brita. And then you could go one step further and boil that.
All right, I know, Felicia, you pretty much have to leave, I suppose.
Yeah,
but,
unfortunately,
did you have any last-minute questions before you move on?
Just one more, I think. And honestly, this is the one that always fascinates me, because when you see those television shows, when they're talking about survival, they never seem to address this. And there has to be a place for waste to go, not just human waste, but your trash, like byproducts and things like this, because otherwise isn't it going to become an issue with wild animals and, you know, just even just the muck around, the dirtiness is going to become a problem for you later on. How would you tell people to address that sort of issue?
Absolutely. Waste is certainly an issue if you were at an encampment, like in one spot for some time. What they say is part of our Leave No Trace ethic, I'm a Leave No Trace master instructor, is try to be at least 200 steps from two things, your camp and a water supply. So you're going to do your best to not pee in the river that you have to drink from, so to speak.
Right.
Wash your dishes in that river. There's going to be exceptions, like I'm camping on an island that isn't 200 feet in diameter. You just do the best you can. But definitely you want to try to, if you can figure out the prevailing winds, try to make sure that everything that you dispose of is downwind from your camp, bury it in a hole, or burn it if possible. The other thing that we suggest to do is pack out. So if it's a camping style situation, put everything in a bag and hang it from a tree and then take it with you. If you don't have soap, one of the things that you can do, you can take a pot of water, from a lake. It doesn't have to be drinkable. You can take sand, and you can take the soft sand, and you can use it as a form of soap because it's mildly abrasive. You rub it in between your hands, get it in and under your fingernails, and it'll get all the dirt out and try to get you clean.
Interesting. Very interesting. Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
No problem.
All right,
thank
you. And you have his website, of course, Wolfman, that's AA, Wolfman, .com. And, Wolfman, we need to take our break right now. I didn't even get to ask you how much time you wanted to hang out with us tonight. I hope you're not paying for the phone call.
Oh, no, that's no problem at all. I have international long distance, so I'm good. But thank you very much for having me on the show. I do run an outdoor education school called Barefoot Bushcraft, and you can go on to barefootbushcraft.com and take a look at some of the courses that we offer. But the meat and potatoes of what I do is on my main website.
Excellent. Well, we appreciate it, Wolfman, and I guess we'll be having you back on a more regular basis here. We definitely can use and appreciate the knowledge.
All right, thank you very much for having me.
All right,
thank
then,
you.
Felicia, same to you. Have a good night for us, and If you want to call me at 9 o'clock after the show, that's fine. Otherwise, maybe I'll talk to you over the weekend.
All right. Well, you have a wonderful night and take care, and thanks for having me on.
All right. Thank you.
Well,
all
goodbye.
Right. I'm flying solo here for the last hour, it appears. So if anyone wants to be a part of the conversation, that's fine. Otherwise, I'm going to take a commercial timeout. I am also going to grab a song break. I need a few minutes here, so... In just a few minutes, it'll be me, you, and some news. We'll be right back.